The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
My next guest has written a book that is described as a must-read for anyone who cares about what happened following the momentous decision that Britain took in the 2016 referendum to leave the EU. Tomorrow he's due to speak at the McGill Summer School, and his theme, how nobody got what they wanted from Brexit. So joining me now is Professor Chris Gregg. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Thanks for having me on.
Now, I'm interested to note that you were a latecomer to the whole Brexit debate. I mean, it was maybe a year before the referendum actually happened that you became interested, shall we say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, actually, the truth of the matter is that for most people in the UK, membership of the EU had really not been a big issue for most people at all. It was only a hard core of people who were very enthusiastic to leave. I began to sort of get interested and participate sort of publicly, I guess, in 2015, and that was mainly because I was an academic working in a business school, and a lot of the things that were being said about trade and about regulation, about supply chains, were things which I just recognized as just not being factually true. And so I just began to dip my toe into things. And then after the referendum result, I launched a blog to sort of talk weekly about the consequences of what was happening. And that ended up getting a big readership. And then the book that you mentioned kind of grew out of that.
The big slogan, Brexit means Brexit. What does it mean?
Brexit means Brexit was one of those kind of very widely mocked slogans. It did actually have a meaning at the time when Theresa May used to say it, and it was meant to sort of signal to people that there wasn't going to be any going back on Brexit, that she sort of that she embraced it, and there wasn't going to be another referendum or anything like that. But I mean, the bigger issue that I guess you're pointing towards was that. And this was the big problem all along, that the Brexit could mean so many different things to different people. And you refer to the subtitle of the book, which is how no one got what they wanted and why they were never going to. And the argument here is to say, well, look, of course, Remainers, which was almost half the country, they weren't going to get what they wanted. But for the people who were kind of pro-Brexit, they meant so many different things by it. So as soon as it was put into practice in any form, they would say, but that's not true Brexit. So any actual Brexit, for some of them, particularly for the most committed of them, wouldn't be true Brexit. And we're seeing the consequences of that. We saw them all through the process, but we're seeing them right now because, of course, one might think, well, look, Brexit should be over with the signing of the withdrawal agreement and the Northern Ireland Protocol and the trade and cooperation agreement. But of course, still, the most committed Brexiters aren't happy with it.
If there was a misstep by anybody, and there were many missteps along the way, David Cameron, of course, holding the referendum particularly, and I suppose we have resonances of what happened to Sir David Amos, but when you think of what happened to Joe Cox, the misstep there at that point, perhaps David Cameron should have postponed the referendum. Also, from polling, they must have known it was going to be a tight-run thing. That was certainly one misstep. But Theresa May ruling out the single market and the customs union.
Yes.
That, to me, was the biggest misstep.
Just to step back a bit sort of before that, she didn't officially do that until January 2017 with the Lancaster House speech, which of course was 6 months after the referendum. Now, one of the things you could say is that the big misstep was in that period that she didn't do anything to construct a process whereby nationally there would have been a proper conversation and a debate about what form Brexit was going to take, because all that we had at that point was the referendum result and nothing else. She could have involved the devolved assemblies. I mean, that would have been difficult in the context of Northern Ireland because at that point, I think the Northern Ireland Assembly wasn't sitting. But nonetheless, the Scottish and Welsh administrations, civil society bodies and so on. But none of that happened. And in fact, and this is astonishing, but it's never been, to my knowledge, denied, there wasn't even a cabinet discussion about that decision to leave single market and customs union. It was a decision taken by Theresa May in consultation with her advisors and then simply announced.
Why do you think that even the hardcore Brexiteers find it hard to admit that the current shortages are down to the Brexit process, that they sent home or told people who were working on visas, perhaps, or would have to work on visas in the United Kingdom, we don't want you, go home, and now we let you back, but we'll give you a short-term visa. I mean, who would want to accept an offer like that, number one? And the truckers just find the whole business of going in and out of Britain too tedious to bother if there's another job they can do.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, there's so many parts of the answer to that question. I mean, the underlying thing, you know, why can't they admit that these things are problems caused by Brexit? I mean, I think, you know, it's just a very big kind of psychological and political, you know, investment in saying that Brexit was a success, because of course all the way along any suggestion there'd be any problems was just said, oh, that's Project Fear, and it's not going to happen. Well, now it's happening, but they still can't kind of admit that. I think there's other parts, though, more subtle parts to the answer to what you're saying, and I think it's to do with that by and large within the EU, the issue of freedom of movement isn't really seen as being an issue of immigration, you know, any more than, you know, people moving from one part of a country to another. We don't see that as being immigration. Whereas I think that the Brexit has never really accepted that kind of that kind of situation, and so they would just think of it, oh well, it's all just immigration, and so why can't we just substitute work visas for freedom of movement? Well, the answer is because work visas, you know, are just inherently more inflexible, more bureaucratic, more cumbersome. I mean, as we're sort of seeing now, I mean, I saw an interesting article written by a Polish lorry driver and journalist saying, you know, do you really expect that we're going to turn around and say, and come, you know, come back for 3 months to help you out, or 6 months or whatever to help you out to get you through Christmas? I mean, it's just not realistic, is it?
Yeah, and the shortages of care workers, for example, many of whom came from outside the island of Britain, again, without security of tenure for a job going forward, you know, the right to have a family and raise them in the UK. Who'd want to take a job like that if there are alternatives?
Yeah, and, you know, this is the great thing about freedom of movement, you know, that it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just an economic thing about people filling jobs. It was a thing about, you know, as you say, about families, about having kinds of options that would include, you know, not necessarily coming to a particular country permanently, but, you know, but at a particular stage of your life, thinking, okay, well, I'll be here for 3 years, but then when my parents get older, I'll go, you know, back to maybe to, you know, my country of origin, or when my kids need schooling and so on. So it's a much richer kind of, a much richer thing than just the economics of filling a job. And of course, you know, you're right. I mean, the other thing about the whole issue is the demographics of a country like the United Kingdom, which has got a very low, in fact, actually a record low of its fertility rate, and it has a rapidly aging population in terms of the number of people over 65. So things like the need for social care and the need for the archetypal thing of fruit picking, you know, you can't, you know, people think of it, can think of it as, oh well, it's just picking some fruit or some vegetables in a field, but, you know, this is, and we call it unskilled work, but, you know, this is hard and in a particular way skilled labor as well. You can't just fill it when you haven't got a domestic workforce.
And the, you know, the obscenity really of seeing vegetables rot in a field because they can't be picked. Did nobody think ahead to this consequence? Do the people who voted for Brexit now ever reflect when they find empty shelves that really this is of their own doing?
Well, I mean, the polling evidence suggests that that actually, you know, a majority of people, including a majority of people who voted Leave, think that Brexit is going badly. But that doesn't necessarily translate into them thinking that they would have voted differently. Mm. And all the way through the process, you know, it's. I mean, there have been fluctuations, but it's always been very close in the opinion polls. So. So it's not, and we remain as a country, you know, very, very, very bitterly divided. I mean, that maybe is not so clear for listeners outside of the United Kingdom. But although, you know, obviously it will be reported in the Irish or the French or the Spanish press, you know, the British do this, the British do that. But we are still, you know, as a country, very, very much divided by it.
Now, thinking forward and the current row over the Northern Ireland protocol and the fact that although the flag was raised earlier on in propositions by the British government that the European Court of Justice would not be an acceptable arbiter over rows on trade in and out of the single market, it wasn't really a red flag for businesses in Northern Ireland. Their concerns were the ease of movement of their goods and the form filling and all the rest, which the EU's four documents have made a hell of a lot easier.
Yeah.
So from your perspective, how do you see that row over the European Court of Justice? Is it simply to keep the Brexit pot stirring well? Or is it something that is really of significant and sovereign importance to Westminster?
It's very difficult to judge this because, I mean, you know, at one level, if this was such a red line, then why sign the Northern Ireland Protocol in the first place? Why not really raise it as an issue until the paper the British government published in July as being a kind of a key issue? And if you look at it that way, you might say, well, this is about, you know, as you just put it, you know, keeping the Brexit pot stirring, because of course for the government there is a segment of their voters for whom, you know, it's an appealing thing to have constant kind of conflicts and rows with the EU. I think another way of looking at it, though, is that for the kind of the hardcore of Brexiters, the people I call the Brexit ultras in the book, you know, right from the beginning, they never accepted the Northern Ireland Protocol. And actually, for some of them, even the whole withdrawal agreement, they saw as being illegitimate in various kinds of ways. And so I think that so for them, you could say, it is a matter of principle. The difficulty is that we have a government that it's very difficult to understand whether they are pursuing, whether they're pursuing things for reasons of principle or for reasons of kind of electoral advantage. And it's very difficult to judge, you know, at this point over the current row, whether, I mean, I suspect, for what it's worth, I think no one really knows what's going to happen, but I suspect that there will be a kind of a fudge on the role of for the ECJ, and that the current row will kind of blow over. But that doesn't mean that there won't be new rows in the future.
Because there are countries within the EU who say, no way, we are not going to give in to them. Give them a sprat and they'll want, whale.
Well, I mean, this has been the difficulty all along. I think with the most sort of hardcore Brexiters is that whatever you give them, they want more. So, I mean, a few years ago, before the referendum, you know, lots of them would talk about, you know, oh, we can be like Norway. Won't this be, you know, what's wrong with that? Norway, of course, obviously being a member of the single market, you know. But then within hours, actually, of the referendum result, they were coming out and saying, no, that's not good enough. It's got to be. And all the time making a harder and harder demand. And of course, that makes it very difficult to negotiate with them because if you're negotiating, you know, you might sort of say, okay, well, let's make a compromise. But then, you know, experience seems to suggest that if you make one compromise, then they will just come back with
more. What Dominic Cummings said about the UK never intending to follow the terms of the Northern Ireland Protocol, number one, you know, do you believe Dominic Cummings? Because a lot of people find him to be a beaten docket in many ways. And if you do believe him, what does it say to the rest of the world about treating the United Kingdom government as any kind of an honest broker in any deal?
Well, the idea that that the Johnson government, you know, never intended to honour the protocol, I mean, that I mean, that has been around, you know, right from the beginning. In other words, this isn't something which has just arisen because of what Dominic Cummings said the other day, whenever it was the other week. And the evidence, if you like, of that is that I think that within days, if I can recall correctly, of the protocol being signed, you know, Boris Johnson and other government ministers were saying, no, there's going to be no Irish sea border, when that was the core provision of the protocol. Yeah. And so, I mean, so either they never intended to honour it, or I suppose if you're more charitable, which is almost equally bad, they didn't understand when signing it. But in terms of the wider issue, I mean, I think that's a, you know, that is a big concern, the question of trust with in particular the question of trust with the European Union has been a problem, you know, all the way through the negotiations, and actually it's one of the things that makes it more difficult to operate a more light touch arrangement in the case of border checks, for example, that, you know, that is really predicated on the UK being trustworthy, and so there's a big reputational price to be paid. But I suppose, again, you know, if you look at it from the perspective of a very kind of committed Brexiter, then they almost would say, well, I mean, I think that some of them are so invested in the idea of antagonism with the EU that they just perhaps almost don't care. Mm.
And that really brings us to the final question, which is whether Brexit and David Cameron's decision to go for the referendum and to allow a simple majority, because such a seismic change that would occur were they to vote yes, and they did vote yes to Brexit, it would appear to deserve more than sort of the 52-48 it got. You'd imagine such a seismic change might have demanded a 60%. But that decision and everything that followed, does it really ultimately point to the breakup of the Union? An independent Scotland, Wales might stick with England. Whatever happens to Northern Ireland is in the lap of the gods, given the Republic situation. Yeah. But is this the start of a process that will end for many in tears?
Look, I'm very kind of, I don't think there's any sort of inevitability about these things, but I think, you know, certainly you'd have to say that that it makes the breakup of the Union more likely rather than less likely. I don't think anyone can really dispute that. And of course, perhaps a key thing to kind of say is that even leaving aside Northern Ireland, and we know that there's an ongoing row there, but Brexit still isn't fully implemented in all kinds of ways. So, I mean, you know, for particular example, you know, the UK does not as yet actually impose import controls on goods coming from the EU. So we're actually, you know, only partway through a process which is going to take years.
All right. Well, I leave you with a thought from one of my listeners, quoting Mark Twain. This is from Jack and Terranure. He says, "It's easier to fool a person than to convince them that they've been fooled." Some wisdom there from our listener. Anyway,
you've got some wise listeners over there.
Brexit Unfolded, How No One Got What They Wanted, and brackets, Why They Were Never Going To, is the name of your book. And Professor Chris Gray, thank you very much for joining us on the programme. And Chris will be participating in the McGill Summer School tomorrow.